These Sunday mornings we've been looking at prayer and the teachings on prayer exhibited in many lives from the Old Testament. And since this is the 10th message in this series, perhaps it might be helpful if I just begin with a brief review of what we've looked at. Remember, we began back at the beginning with Adam and Eve, whom I knew well. Who taught us the nature of prayer, that is, its conversation, simple conversation with God, responding to God's questions and hearing God's words. And then with Abraham, we learned the basis of prayer, that prayer is grounded and founded on the character of God. It's the faithfulness of God that makes it possible to pray at all. And Abraham was a great example of that to us. In the life of Jacob, we learned the proper attitude on our part toward prayer, a sense of great helplessness, of utter brokenness as far as relying upon our own cleverness is concerned, and a trust that God can work. In Moses, we understood and learned how prayer supports us in times when we are weak and even failing, undergirds us and takes us in our weakness to make us strong. And then from the life of Jabez, that semi-orphan boy who had all the handicaps of life against him, we learned how practical prayer is, how it deals with very real problems that we confront in our daily experience. Then Hannah taught us the fruitfulness of prayer, the way prayer, laying hold of God, can change barrenness into fruitfulness and minister to a whole nation in a time of need. In the prayer of Solomon at the dedication of the temple, we saw something of the scope of prayer, how wide it is, how many different things it can cover, and what it touches upon in our life. Daniel taught us something of the requirement for prayer, that is, the sense of dealing with our sins honestly before God. And last time in Job, we learned the relationships of prayer, that we're tied together with others in this and learn to intercede for them. And now this morning we come to the use of prayer in life's emergencies. What to expect God to do when we are overwhelmed by our circumstances and we find them too big to handle. When we're outnumbered and outclassed by what we're up against. And for that, we go to the life of Asa, the third king of Judah, grandson of Solomon, found in the 14th chapter of 2 Chronicles. Remember, you take the freeway to the Psalms, turn left and go 5 blocks, and you come out at 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles 14. Now, the first thing we learn about King Asa when he ascended the throne is very encouraging. We're told in verse 2 of the 14th chapter, "And Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. He took away the foreign altars and the high places," that is, the altars erected up on the tops of the hills, "and he broke down the pillars and hewed down the Asherim." These are references to obscene idols, sexual objects erected for the worship of the people around a very degrading religious rite. And the king destroyed those in the land. "He commanded Judah to seek the Lord, the God of their fathers, and to keep the law and the commandments. He also took out of all the cities of Judah the high places and the incense altars, and the kingdom had rest under him. In other words, when King Asa ascended to the throne, the first thing he did was to lead the nation in a moral awakening. He did what many of us think is wrong to do, many people think is wrong to do today, and that is he began to legislate righteousness. Put in terms of our own day, what he did was to clean out the adult bookstores, close the massage parlors, confiscate all the pornographic films, close the adult movies, jail the drug pushers, and put back, restore the reading of the Bible and public prayers in the public schools and the courts of the land. Isn't that interesting? Well, it's what he did. The equivalent of that is what he did. And that's what many tell us that you can't do. You can't legislate righteousness. And they're perfectly right. Nevertheless, though it didn't work to accomplish that, because it never does and never is intended to, it was a step in the right direction. It did something useful. It was, according to the text here, it produced a situation which can be described as the kingdom had rest under him. All the degrading, disturbing, defiling things were put away. Now they were maybe driven underground. It didn't eliminate them. And laws and legislation don't change people's hearts. That's perfectly true. But what it does is control the manifestations of it so that there's a sense, there's an ability to carry out orderliness and to inhibit the manifestations of evil in crime and public shame and disgrace. And that's what the king did. And it's properly recorded here that the kingdom, therefore, entered into a period of rest. There was a moral breathing spell introduced by these practices. And then King Asa did something else remarkably relevant to our own day. As the account goes on, it tells us that in a time of peace, he greatly increased the defense budget. That's interesting, isn't it? Verse 6, he built fortified cities in Judah, for the land had rest. He had no war in those years, for the Lord gave him peace. And he said to Judah, let us build these cities and surround them with walls and towers and gates and bars. The land is still ours, because we have sought the Lord our God. We have sought him, and he's given us peace on every side. So they built and prospered. And Asa had an army of 300,000 from Judah, armed with bucklers and spears, and 280,000 men from Benjamin that carried shields and drew bows. All these were mighty men of valor. As you know, this southern kingdom of Judah consisted of the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And each tribe committed their young men of a certain age to be trained for the army. One tribe, 300,000, the other 280,000, a total of 580,000 men. Now, that's a rather remarkable figure, because this is a tiny country, less than half the size of California. And yet, its standing army, in peacetime, was almost as large as the total army that the United States maintains in times of peace. I called General Ray Miller in our congregation to check on that. And he told me that the present standing army numbers around 700,000 men. For this superpower of our day. And here's a tiny little country with 580,000 men under arms in a time of peace. Well, they would soon need them because across the Red Sea, in the country of Ethiopia, a murderous warlord by the name of Zerah was beginning to move out on a conquest of the world with an army of 1 million men. And in verse 9, we read about it. Zerah the Ethiopian came out against them with an army of 1 million men and 300 chariots and came as far as Marishah. And Asa went out to meet him, and they drew up their lines of battle in the valley of Zephathah at Marishah. Here's 1 million men that now come up against the land of Israel. They came all the way out of Africa, south of Egypt, up through all the desert and across the Sinai Peninsula. And now they're right at the doorsteps of Jerusalem. And King Asa went down to meet them. The place that's mentioned here is south and west of Jerusalem, right at the place where the hills meet the coastal plain, right near the spot where David and Goliath had their famous encounter. When King Asa came with his army of 580,000 men, which must have seemed very impressive when they were first gathered together, he looks out on this plain and it's covered as far as the eye can see with the tents of the soldiers that have come against him. And when the scouts report the size of the army, 1 million men, and the presence of 300 armed chariots, which would be equal in our day to tanks, armored tanks, Asa suddenly realizes that he's outnumbered almost 2 to 1, and he's totally outclassed by this maneuverable band of chariots. And as he sees this tremendous host, he suddenly feels led to pray. And this is what he prayed. And Asa cried to the Lord his God, O Lord, there is none like thee to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on thee, and in thy name we have come against this multitude. O Lord, thou art our God. Let not man prevail against thee. I wonder if you've ever felt like King Asa did. You know, the reason these stories are in the Old Testament, as the New Testament tells us, they were written down for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the age have come. They reflect experiences that we're all called to face at times. It's true, we're not kings with great armies, facing even greater armies. But in the kingdom of our own lives, we often encounter this very thing, and our feelings must be very much like King Asa felt. Have you ever had this experience of thinking you were secure, plenty of money in the bank, good health, future looked bright and rosy, and then all of a sudden, wham, bam, disaster looms? And you realize you're outnumbered, outgunned, and outclassed, and up against a circumstance that's too big for you to handle. Ever feel that way? I'm sure there are some right here this morning that are facing that very kind of a thing. And this is what Asa faced as well. Now, the prayer that we have here is only one verse long. I'm sure it does not represent everything the king said. You pray longer than this when you're facing an army of 1 million men. But this is probably a very brief outline of the points that he covered in his prayer. And they're very helpful. And they're recorded, remember, for our instruction. When we're up against situations like this, this is the way to pray. Notice the first thing he does, very first thing, is to recognize the unique ability of God to give help. Unique ability. Nobody helps like God does. O Lord, there is none like Thee to help. The reason, of course, for that is God knows so much more about us than other people can. And there's so many possibilities He can lay hold of to deliver. I don't know if all this went through Asa's mind, but he must have begun to look back in history and think of the many different ways God employed to deliver His people. God has more ways of delivering people than McDonald's has hamburgers. He could use, for instance, a thunderstorm and giant hailstones like He did once with Joshua. He might use the jawbone of an ass, as He did with Samson, to overcome a great army of Philistines. He might use torches hidden in jars, as He did with Gideon, when a great host of the Midianites were confronted by a simple little band of 300 men. He may use just the rumor of another invading army that's coming, as He did in the case of King Hezekiah, when the armies of Syria surrounded the city of Jerusalem under Rabshakeh, the general. And a rumor came that another Egyptian army was coming up. And Rabshakeh folded up all his tents and disappeared overnight. God, that took care of that threat. He may use a sound in the tops of the mulberry trees, as happened once with David, when he was confronted with a Philistine host, and they heard a strange sound that sounded like marching feet, and they too thought an army was coming and took to their heels and ran. He may use a woman with a nail in a tent, as he did with Sisera, the Syrian general, in the days of Deborah and Barak. There's 1,001 things God can do to set us free. He may have us fight the battle. He may tell us, as He did with Asa's son, Jehoshaphat, the very next king, go on out with your army, but there's not going to be any battle. I'll deliver you without a single blow being struck. And who knows what God can do? That's the point of this. And the very first thing the king recognizes is there's none like God to help. He has 1,000,001 resources to command and 1,000,001 ways of going about it. And who can tell what He might employ? And then as the king recognized part of the uniqueness of God is that it doesn't make any difference whether you're mighty or weak. This word between the mighty and the weak is not a good translation. What it really means is whether you are mighty or weak. You see, human contribution to the victory is unimportant, insignificant in God's eyes. He can use armies if He wants to. He can use just a single individual. I've always thrilled at that account of Jonathan, David's close friend, King Saul's son, who with his armor bearer are out one morning when the Philistines are attacking Israel. And as they come over the brow of the hill, suddenly they run into a band of about 100 or more Philistines. And they fortunately see them in time and hide themselves. And they begin to talk between themselves. And Jonathan says to his armor bearer, God is the kind of a God, it doesn't make any difference to Him. He can deliver with many or with few. And we could sneak out here the back way and go on back, but why not? Let's attack Him. Since God's that kind of God. And He did. And the two of them put the Philistines to rout. And there was a great victory in the camp of Israel. Because Jonathan saw that God is the kind of a God that it doesn't make any difference to Him whether human beings have a lot to offer or nothing to offer. It's all the same to Him. Church history and the annals of missions are full of stories of one man or one woman who went out to a tough situation and trusted God, and God did mighty works through just a single person armed with confidence and faith in the promises of God. Mother Teresa in Calcutta, Lillian Dixon out in the island of Taiwan with her myriad of ministries to the hurting and the poor and the broken and the blind and the weak. Cameron Townsend, who started single-handedly translating the Bible into Indian tongues and began the whole worldwide ministry of Wycliffe Bible translators. What difference does it make whether you have anything yourself or nothing at all? God can work. That's the point. I get awfully tired of some of the accounts I read today that suggest that until we get $1 billion raised, we'll never be able to do anything in world evangelism. Nonsense. God can work with many or with few, with the mighty or with the weak. Doesn't make any difference to Him. And then the second thing the king did was to request specific and divine aid for the present emergency. O Lord, he said, help us, O Lord our God. Help us, for we rely on Thee, and in Thy name we have come against this multitude. Now, when you're confronted with a situation like that, you haven't time to pray around the world. I remember hearing of a man who was invited to pray for someone who was dying in the hospital. And he stood beside the bed and started his prayer. Bless the missionaries in China and the ones in India and the ones in Africa and so on, and kept on going. And finally, they stopped him after a moment or so and said, sir, I'm sorry. While you were in India, the patient died. And it's important to come to the point in our prayers and to deal with the specific situation as King Asa did here. Help us, O Lord. And when you get into trouble like this, ask God for help. Now, don't tell Him what to do. That's what mistakes so many of us make. We've got it all outlined, written down, perhaps, and say, Lord, first take this step. Then when that happens, do this. And we work it all out, the whole strategy. And God's best answer, most frequently, is to check the square that says none of the above. He has His own way of working, and He will not give way to us. And that's what makes us get so angry at God. We've got it all worked out, and He won't follow our program, and that makes us mad. But the king leaves it up to God. Help us, he says. Now, he's got the army there, and he intends to fight, but he knows that God's way of helping could be in 1,001 ways, and he leaves it with Him. And then the third thing, he reminds God of a divinely established relationship. O Lord, Thou art our God. We didn't make You our God. You made us our God. You chose us. You created this relationship we have. We're Your people. And therefore, if this battle is lost, You lose. So, he says, let not man prevail against Thee. And isn't it wonderful to realize when you come to the New Testament, that's exactly the ground that we stand on in our prayers before God? If God be for us, who can be against us? Paul cries in Romans 8. And the book of Hebrews says that we're not to love money or seek after those things, because he says, I have said I will never, never, ever, ever leave you nor forsake you. And the result is we cry, God, if God is our helper, what can man do unto us? What can a man do? And this is what King Asa is crying. Any defeat would be God's defeat. And he stands upon that relationship. Now remember, the relationship gives boldness. It's because we're sons that we're invited before to come before God and ask for help. In Hebrews again, it says, "Let us come boldly unto the throne of grace to obtain mercy and to find grace to help in time of need." And that's we're invited to come boldly because it's not only a possibility, it's a promise that God Himself has given that we shall obtain mercy and find grace. It's already ours to help in time of need. So we're exhorted to come like that. Now let's look at the result of this prayer. It's given here in verse 12. "So the Lord defeated the Ethiopians before Asa and before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled." All put in just that one brief count. But what a battle that must have been. There was an immediate and overwhelming victory, a thorough and complete rout of the enemy. We're told Asa and the people that were with him pursued them as far as Gerar, and the Ethiopians fell until none remained alive. Isn't that amazing? For they were broken before the Lord and His army. "The men of Judah carried away very much booty, and they smote all the cities round about Gerar, for the fear of the Lord was upon them. They plundered all the cities, for there was much plunder in them. And they smote the tents of those who had cattle, and carried away sheep in abundance and camels, and then they returned to Jerusalem." Now, this army was more than just marching men. It was accompanied by great herds of animals who were there for food and great supplies. And Asa was enabled to capture all these, to take these animals and use them for his own purposes. Now, we might leave the story there, were it not for a very fascinating sequel that is traced in chapters 15 and 16. And I'm not going to read these at any length at all, so don't panic. But in both of these chapters, King Asa is met by a prophet of God, a different prophet in each one, but with two quite contrasting messages for him. In the first one, immediately following the battle with the Ethiopians, he's met by the prophet Azariah, who emphasizes the human responsibility in prayer and walking closely with God. This verse 15, chapter 15. "The Spirit of God came upon Azariah the son of Oded, and he went out to meet Asa. And he said to him, 'Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with him.'" Very important principle. The Lord is with you when you are with him. "If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you." Now that sounds strange, doesn't it? That sounds like it's a contradiction of the very thing we were just quoting from Hebrews. "I will never, never, ever, ever leave you nor forsake you." But you see, we have to understand this is the language of experience here. The reality is God never does forsake us. Never does. He never leaves us or forsakes us. But He seems to. In our experience, we sense that we are alone. We don't hear His voice. We don't feel any inner witness or response. And it looks like we've forsaken Him. You know why? It's God's way of reminding us that in some sense we have forsaken Him. Looks like He's forsaken us, but it's really we have turned away from Him. And therefore the reminder is, the Lord is with you when you are with Him. Now we must always be reminded that none of this is possible to us without God's gracious Spirit at work in our own hearts. We won't turn to Him unless He's at work in us. But the point is, the choice of whether we walk in the power of the Spirit available to us is ours. And we can choose to be with Him and seek His face. And when we do, He will be found by us. He promises. And on the other hand, if we don't do this, He will leave us, apparently, and we feel abandoned and left alone and forsaken. He hasn't delivered us over entirely, but it feels that way. Now, I know this includes more than prayer. It means also meditating, seeking His face, confessing our sins, whatever may else be involved. But this phrase, if you seek Him, certainly refers clearly to prayer. I ran across a helpful quote on the ministry of prayer that I'd like to share with you from the writings of Reginald E. O. White, English writer. He says, prayer lies at the heart of all experience of God. In prayer, God is known and met and touched. In prayer, all our knowledge about God kindles into life. Our understanding of the Scripture gains personal illumination and power. Our whole conduct and career passes consciously under the divine judgment. In prayer, the soul is molded and attuned to fresh obedience and confronted with new duties. Our relationship to others is seen in a new perspective, and conscience grows tender again. In prayer, vision is clarified, the horizons are broadened, the goal becomes better defined, and the inner resources by which the soul lives are replenished from eternal springs of power, hopefulness, and peace. And he concludes it, prayerless religion is mere theory. And then look at the results. Verse 8, when Asa heard these words, the prophecy of Azariah the son of Oded, he took courage and put away the abominable idols from all the land of Judah and Benjamin and from the cities which he had taken in the hill country of Ephraim. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that was in front of the vestibule of the house of the Lord. And then, without reading it, the rest of the chapter goes on to outline how he gathered the tribes together. And they had a great time of cleansing and renewal before God, the heart being changed as well as the outward behavior adjusted. And there was great rejoicing in the kingdom. And a tremendous period of some 30 years of peace was granted to them because they set their hearts to walk with God, to obey what God had said to do. And God responded by leading them into this place of renewal and cleansing and blessing. Now in chapter 16, you have a different story. 30 some years later, the kingdom of Judah is now being threatened by Baasha, the king of Israel, the northern tribes. And he comes down and begins to set up, defenses in a border town that makes it obvious he's going to attack the king of Judah. And this time Asa doesn't turn to the Lord. Here's a picture, you see, of what happens. When he relies upon his own rationality. He begins to play politics. And he does a rather strange thing. He took the treasure out of the temple of God. He robbed the temple. and sent the money up to King of Syria on the northern side of Israel. And using the money from the temple, he suborned the king of Syria, that is, he bought his loyalty, and urged him to break the peace treaty that Syria and Israel had together and launch an attack upon Israel from the north. And it worked. Sometimes politics does work. And the king of Syria came against the king of Israel and took some of his cities. And Asa must have felt that he was pretty clever. He worked it all out on his own scheme. But now God sends another prophet to meet him, and you read about him in verse 7. At that time Hanani the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, "Because you relied on the king of Syria and did not rely on the Lord your God," now listen, "the army of the king of Syria has escaped you." That's a remarkable revelation. It indicates that if Asa had walked with God in this circumstance as he did before, when the Ethiopians came, God would have not only overcome the threat from Israel, but he would have delivered the king of Syria and his armies into his hand. But because he chose to walk by his own cleverness and his own rationality, he was delivered over, he lost this great opportunity. And furthermore, Hanani goes on, "Were not the Ethiopians and the Libyans a huge army with exceedingly many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he gave them into your hand." And here's a great verse then. I urge you to memorize it. "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show his might in behalf of those whose heart is blameless toward him." "You have done foolishly," he said, "for from now on you will have wars." And then one further reference in verse 12. "In the 39th year of his reign, Asa was diseased in his feet, and his disease became severe. Yet even in his disease, he did not seek the Lord, but sought help from physicians." And that led to his eventual death. Now, God sent the prophet to point out to Asa that his reliance upon his own wisdom and cleverness was very destructive. It meant first a lost opportunity for a great victory he could have had. It meant second a very troubled future. You're going to have wars from now on. And it meant also a very personal, painful reminder in his own body that something had gone wrong with his walk. See, his feet became diseased. God speaks in these symbolic terms to us all through the Scriptures. And this was a symbol to Asa that something had gone wrong with his walk. Remember when Jesus gathered with his disciples in the upper room and he took the basin, he washed not their whole bodies. That had already been done, he said, when they believed in the word of the Lord. But he washed their feet. That's where they'd gone wrong. And so these scriptures remind us that this is the area of problem. This is the subtle danger of resting upon our own resources and not upon God to work and use those resources. But our ultimate trust must be in God himself. I think the greatest question we face in our spiritual life is this: on whom or what do you count for success? Is it on man or God? On money or the Spirit of God? On the flesh or the Spirit? That's the key. That's the way you can tell whether your solutions are God's solutions or not. What happens if it fails? Is God going to be put to the test and shamed by this if it fails? Or are you and others that you're counting on, are you going to be dishonored? Trust in God is always that God will work. And if He doesn't, the whole thing collapses. Work according to His promise. That's where the life of faith begins. Well, let's stand and we'll be dismissed in prayer. Thank you, our Father, for these words that both encourage us and sober us. We thank you that you are our God, and there's none like you to help us in times of pressure and danger and distress and overwhelming odds. And yet, Lord, how easy it is for us to begin to trust ourselves after that and think that we can, with our cleverness, work it all out on our own terms. Keep us from this, Lord. Help us to learn this lesson. Remind us of it again and again, that we may learn to be men and women, boys and girls, who walk in trust in the living God. We pray in your name. Amen.